This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area and the Western Slope, Thursday, May 16, 2013. An attentive audience at the DMEA building in Montrose Wednesday night got a glimpse into the inner workings of the 75-year-old co-op as six candidates squared off for three seats on the governing board. The Delta Montrose Electric Association has about 33,000 customers in Delta and Montrose counties who elect the nine paid board members who serve three-year terms. KVNF's Marty Durland has more.
The Montrose League of Women Voters presented the candidate forum with a 30-second time limit for questions and a one-minute limit for answers. Montrose candidate Jim Elder had a pretty complete laundry list of the topics that were covered during the one-hour question and answer session.
Some of the issues facing DMEA in the next several years are rising electric rates, the contract with Tri-State, Senate Bill 252, utilizing the current fiber optic lines that we have, low employee morale, and so on.
A management and financial audit of the entire organization, undertaken by the board at a cost of around $80,000, is one controversial issue. Here's incumbent Ed Marston, who's running against Olin Lund in the 3rd District.
The present board took back its responsibilities this year by ordering an assessment of board and staff. When the three directors first began pushing an assessment, 20 or more managers started coming to every board meeting. In reaction to this, a majority gradually got behind the assessments. Among other things, we wanted to know if average annual compensation of $193,000 for DMEA's seven top managers makes sense.
Senate Bill 252, which would double the renewable energy standard for rural electricity cooperatives, is also a hot-button issue, with Republicans and DMEA's supplier, Tri-State, saying it will drastically increase the cost of electricity for rural Colorado. Governor Hickenlooper has yet to sign the bill. Candidate Olin Lund.
There is talk, the numbers I have been told, is it will be an added burden of $2,000 per meter on average. I know certainly the farmers are concerned because they think that they're going to get, or they recognize that they're going to get hit very hard.
But incumbent Tony Prendergast from Crawford was against the bill for a different reason.
We were trying to insert language in there that would allow us to bump past our 5% cap currently on local distributed generation, our 5% cap in the contract with Tri-State. We were not able to get that through. But so we chose not to support it without having more of a local benefit. As far as the overall bill goes, 20% by 2020, 2% rate cap, there's going to be a lot of implementation dilemmas with it, I think. It was a hasty bill, but I think we'll survive it. I don't think it's going to be quite as dire as Tri-State has predicted.
The discussion of renewables included DMEA's own South Canal hydroelectric project. Candidate Kay Heinschel, Prendergast's opponent in the South District.
My understanding is the South Canal project cost $18 million. You can build a lot of things for $18 million, and you can run them 365 days out of the year. The only reason that I would want to see us get involved in another hydro project, if, like the one that we have, if it's generating costs on a six-month period of water availability is lower than the wholesale power rate from Tri-State, I'd say build all of them that you can, because it helps DMEA.
Candidate Erica Lewis Kennedy, a former Montrose mayor.
Again, I think a diverse portfolio is very important. Just as there were a lot of naysayers in 1974 at the Dallas Water Project, and known as the Ridgeway Dam, it was imperative to the growth and sustainability of this valley. We are in a drought season. As we look at weather patterns, they go up, they go down. Let's hope that they stay up. But I think it's very viable for the future, and we need to continue projects of that nature.
There were lots more informed questions from the audience and lots more polite disagreement from the candidates. KVNF will air the entire forum in the coming weeks. DMEA members will find ballots in their mailboxes next week and must return them no later than June 13th. Or members can vote in person at DMEA's annual meeting at the Hotchkiss Senior Center Friday, June 14th from 8 to 9:30 a.m. For KVNF News, I'm Marty Derlin.
The Aspen Times reports that the oil and gas industry is claiming that closures of land and increased regulations contemplated in the White River National Forest will make drilling uncompetitive. Five organizations affiliated with the gas industry submitted comments last winter to the Forest Service as part of the agency's effort to rewrite rules of where drilling will be allowed and under what circumstances. The federal agency is overhauling an outdated plan from 1993. Conservation groups have waged a well-documented effort to restrict drilling, but gas industry groups have been less vocal. The comments they submitted to the Forest Service were obtained Tuesday by the Aspen Times. Three oil industry trade groups contend that the Forest Service's analysis is skewed towards restricting oil and gas development. The proposed action by the Forest Service would allow leasing on about 260,000 of the 2.27 million acres in the forest, as opposed to the 417,000 acres made available in the 1993 plan. According to comments submitted by the Western Energy Alliance of Denver, Public Land Advocacy of Aurora, and Western Slope Oil and Gas Association of Grand Junction, quote, "There is no alternative that allows for reasonable oil and natural gas development to take place in the White River National Forest, and the only difference among the alternatives is the level of restrictions imposed on development." The three organizations asked the Forest Service to include an alternative that provides for the proper balance between responsible oil and natural gas development and resource conservation in the White River National Forest. The trade groups contend that the Forest Service's closures and increased regulations will increase costs and make assets in the Piceance Basin uncompetitive in the oil and gas industry. They said companies already operating in the forest won't have incentive to expand existing fields. The gas industry groups claimed that gas development should be allowed to continue as projected in the 1993 oil and gas plan. This statement was included in their comments to the Forest Service. At a time when the American public is becoming increasingly concerned about the amount of energy it imports, further oil and natural gas development in Colorado could continue to help reduce our reliance on foreign imports. Two gas producers, Noble Energy and SG Interests, also submitted comments for the Forest Service planning effort. The Forest Service received 665 total responses to its gas and oil plan. The agency determined that 555 were, quote, "organized campaign responses," with comments often submitted as form letters. There were 110 original responses. The vast majority of the responses are from individuals, organizations, or local governments that support greater restrictions on gas drilling. The Forest Service isn't scheduled to release a final environmental impact statement on its oil and gas plan until next year at the earliest. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that a new study indicates bird species considered tolerant of human activity may be more adversely impacted than previously believed. The study, authored by Aaron Strasser and Julie Heath of Boise State University, was published in the British Ecological Society's Journal of Applied Ecology. A key finding of the study was that American kestrels nesting close to roads and developed areas had elevated stress hormones and high rates of nest abandonment, about 10 times higher than kestrels in less developed areas. American kestrels are small, colorful falcons, often seen perched along roadways, and they are abundant in urban and agricultural areas. The study involved the monitoring of 89 nest boxes with 28 nests along Idaho's Interstate 84 as well as on posts and trees along secondary roads in other areas during the breeding seasons of 2008 and 2009. Most of the nests that failed, 23 nests or 88%, did so during incubation. Only 3 nests failed during the nestling stage. 16 of the 26 failed nests, or 62%, were abandoned. The study says cavity nesting birds, such as kestrels, inhabiting noisy environments, may compensate for decreased auditory cues by increasing vigilance behavior, such as visual scans from the nest entrance or flushing from the nest. This leads to changes in energy allocation or extended periods away from the nest during incubation, and this behavior appears to be followed at a high rate by nest abandonment. Given that the vast majority of land in the continental United States is within a mile of a road, wildlife increasingly are exposed to chronic levels of road noise. The resulting increase in stress levels could cause fundamental changes, which, over time, could lead to more population declines. The Denver Post reports that corrections officials are alerting judges throughout Colorado that errors appear to have resulted in early, improper release dates from prison for hundreds of prisoners they sentenced. The judges are reviewing the case files so they can decide which of those already released from prison should return to serve out the longer sentences required by state law. Other cases involve prisoners who are on the verge of release, who may now see their sentences extended. These are the early results of an audit still underway by the Colorado Department of Corrections. Governor John Hickenlooper ordered the department to conduct the audit after it was disclosed that a parolee believed to have murdered Corrections Chief Tom Clements was released from prison early because of a clerical error. Corrections officials said so far the audit has found serious questions in the sentences of 349 individuals either already released from prison or scheduled for release. Of those, judges have amended sentences in 56 cases. According to the Post, the errors occurred for a variety of reasons. In some cases, judicial clerks may have given incorrect sentences to the corrections department. In others, corrections officials may have interpreted sentences incorrectly. A full breakdown is not yet available on how the errors occurred. The audit is still in the preliminary stages and is not expected to be finished until July. The state has identified 8,415 individuals whose sentences need reviews, with at least 2,500 warranting a more intensive look. About a fifth of the intensive reviews have been completed. If the current error rate continues, serious sentencing flaws could be detected in the cases of more than 1,000 individuals. Thus concludes today's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria. Good day.